13th in the Lincoln Hall Theater, 802 South Wright Street on the U of I campus. Harrison Schmidt, the only geologist ever to walk on the moon, will present A Trip to the Moon and Beyond. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Chris Mooney. He's a journalist who specializes in writing about the relationship of science and politics. He is the Washington correspondent for Seed magazine, which is, in a sense, kind of a popular science magazine, but particularly one of the things that it's interested in is that same sort of relationship, a relationship between science and politics. Chris Mooney has written for The American Prospect, Mother Jones, Wired, The Washington Post, Slate, and many other publications. And this morning, we will be talking about some of the arguments that he makes in his first book, one that has been getting quite a lot of attention. The title of his book is The Republican War on Science. It is out fairly recently now. It's published by Basic Books. And in the book, he makes the argument that, on the one hand, science has probably never been more important to understanding the big political issues that face us today. At the same time, he says, science and scientists have less influence with the federal government than at any other time, at least since the administration of Richard Nixon. And in the book, he makes this argument, and I'm sure he will give examples, that this administration in particular, the Bush administration, has taken many positions that run counter to overwhelming scientific consensus. And the administration has done it in order to maintain the support of both social conservatives and also people in the business community. Questions and comments are certainly welcome as we continue here through this hour. The only thing we ask of people who call is that they are brief in their comments so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program going. But people who are listening are certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So for local folks, use that number. And the toll-free, that's good for anybody who is listening. If it would be a long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. Mr. Mooney, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
That's good to be here.
Just as a general way of beginning, and we can get into some specific examples, and you list quite a few of them in the book, I suppose that there are some people who would say that to make a statement like the Republican War on Science or to single out the Bush administration is to ignore the fact that it's happened before. Other administrations have done it, and Democrats and liberals have done it. Is it really the case? Do you really think that it is a greater this kind of tendency that we've been talking about to support bad science or poor science or pseudoscience as a way of supporting your political viewpoint? Is it something that Republicans are really more inclined to do than Democrats, or this administration has been more inclined to do than previous ones?
Yeah, well, it is true that the left has done it and other administrations have done it, but it is also true that we have a unique problem now that has happened under the Bush administration, and that is, I think, a result of political trends in the Republican Party. So both statements are true. And just to elaborate, the reason we know, or can I think reasonably surmise, that there is a unique problem now is, of course, not only is there an unprecedented rift between the nation's scientific community and the Bush administration over precisely this, but if you look back over the course of American political history in recent years, you certainly will not find, you will find fights over politics and science, but you will not find anything that parallels the extent of the allegations against the Bush administration, which are on a vast array of seemingly unconnected issues, ranging from climate change to mercury pollution to who's on a scientific advisory committee to the presentation of information about sexual health on government websites. What ties it all together, why we have the perfect storm right now, and is the simple fact that today's Republican Party, and Bush is the leader of it, is the party of the modern conservative movement, and it is appealing to industry, it is appealing to religious conservatives, and they are getting what they want under the Bush administration. And what they want is to give their own contrarian, often misleading take on the science in a wider range of areas. And sure enough, those are the areas where we're seeing these abuses of science.
Well, in the book, I think you do a fairly good job early on of sketching out the argument that you make and giving particular examples. And maybe just to make sure that people understand where you're coming from and the critique that you're making, what you're saying is essentially is that science has been politicized. So let me give you a chance to ask a question that you pose rhetorically here very early on, so that people will get a sense of what you're talking about. What exactly does that mean, to politicize science?
It means a lot of things. But when I use it, I mean to try to achieve a political goal, not by making an honest political argument about policy, ethics, economics, and so forth, but to try to use science as a way of getting what you really want politically. So to cloak what you're actually trying to do in the language of science, thereby abusing science for a political reason.
You would make the argument, I'm sure, that in supporting quote unquote bad science, you will end up with bad policymaking.
Mm-hmm. At least in a lot of cases,
and we can talk about that. But I guess do you make the argument that, in fact, that aside, bad policy aside, that this is somehow bad for science, for the whole enterprise of science, and for scientists?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, if scientists have any stake in anything, it is that scientific knowledge be properly translated into the political process. So, of course, and it's also bad for scientists in the sense that part of the war on science that I discuss involves actual political attacks on scientists. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they suffer in that way as well.
Does this mean that certain kinds of work that perhaps should be done, or at least you would make the argument, would lead to greater knowledge and betterment of the way people live and so forth, that somehow that research that perhaps should get done or otherwise would get done is not?
Well, I think that's something of a different question, because there are many ways to fund research, and mm-hmm. and actually I'm not making an argument centrally about the funding of science, which comes from both industry and from the government and other sources. I'm making an argument about the distortion of science. So, sure, research is going ahead in a wide variety of areas that are controversial. The problem is that when science reaches a verdict on something, when the scientific consensus becomes clear, it then becomes attacked. So it's a translation problem. It's not that the science isn't happening. It's that it is being attacked, and the reason it's being attacked is because people do not want the science to create pressure for political action.
Hmm. Do you think that part of this, and again, this perhaps might be something of a side issue, but part of the problem here is that most people don't really understand what scientists do, and particularly they have, I think, a misguided sort of understanding about even once a scientist has come to a particular kind of conclusion, just how sure one ever is, and that scientists, sort of part of the business is for scientists to try to poke holes in the things that they think that they know. And I think a lot of people take that for a weakness, whereas I think a lot of scientists would say, well, no, actually, that's the strength of the scientific method. I'm not sure that people really get that.
Sure, you're right. And one of the reasons that it's so easy to misuse science or to mislead people about science is, of course, because it's really easy to, for example, exploit uncertainty in a misleading way. So there's always uncertainty in science. There's always things that aren't known. That is a strength of science because, of course, scientific knowledge is by its nature tentative and subject to revision, and this is how knowledge progresses. And science is not arrogant enough to say that we know everything and none of the things we claim are ever going to change or be proven wrong. That's a great thing, but if you just selectively, if you want to undermine something that science has developed a lot of information about, then you just say, oh, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. Well, duh, because it's science, but that's not a bad thing. So this kind of thing goes on a lot, and it's really easy to snow people with this kind of argument, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and that is, in fact, one of the things that you point to as a specific example that the administration has done, that is trying to play up the fact that on some particular issue, for example, global warming, I suppose one of it would be the easy ones to reach for, but on some particular issue, there is not 100% agreement among scientists. And so that makes it easier for you to say, well, we really don't know about this. We don't have an answer yet. Scientists do not all agree. This is certainly a serious problem. We need to do more research, but we really shouldn't be jumping ahead of the science and then deciding that we're going to do something based on incomplete understanding of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the problem there is that scientific knowledge is never complete. We know some things, but not everything. But in terms of translation of science into policy, a lot of times you've got to act before all the information is in, because if you don't, the problem may be getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, attacking the science and exaggerating uncertainty is a goal for creating political gridlock.
In that particular case, though, and that, as I have extemporized, that's exactly what the president has said about global warming.
It's
and in
true.
A sense, you would have to say, well, that is in fact fair to a point. Now, I suppose it depends on how you say that, because the fact is that we don't have a complete understanding of global warming. We're not exactly sure what's going on. We're not exactly sure how it'll play out over the long term.
Yeah, that's where the real uncertainty is, right, is what the future holds,
And there are scientists, and you know, one might say that the majority of scientists are on one side, but there are some scientists who say, we're really not quite sure about what this is and what caused it and how things will play out. So if the president stands up and says that, isn't that a completely fair statement of the facts as they are? Then in fact, the scientific community, there is some division among the scientific community.
Well, actually, first of all, there's actually virtually no division about the central fact that humans are causing global warming now. I mean, there's virtually no debate. It's very misleading to say, oh, there's a big debate. There's not a big debate. Now, about what global warming will do in the future, obviously, we don't know, one has a crystal ball. So there, you know, there is certainly room for argument. It's misleading for the president to do what he has done in the past, which is just selectively talk about uncertainty without acknowledging what scientists actually know. That's distorting the state of scientific understanding. It's a selective presentation of what should be a much more rich and detailed picture that will show quite clearly that we do know to a reasonable degree of certainty that we're causing it. Now, selectively citing a couple of outlier scientists who disagree is also a selective misuse of science. And it's in some ways worse, because it means that when you do that, you are essentially appointing yourself as a politician to do something you should never do, which is to say which scientists are right and which scientists are wrong. Politicians should not be in that position. Politicians should take science advice from mainstream, respected, careful scientific assessment processes or scientific expert organizations. And those have all been very firm in saying that humans are causing global warming, and they have not, at this point, they don't really even give much credibility to the outlier position anymore.
Mm. And you're now draw a kind of a straight line between the position of the administration, say, let's just stick with this particular example, the position on that example, and this tendency to try to play up uncertainty over the issue and the cause. You draw a straight line between that and the administration's interest in supporting industries that, if we decided that we were going to do something different, indeed would have to do something different, would pay part of the cost, and so that people in the fossil fuels industries, for example, or perhaps other industries, don't want things to change. I mean, is that you draw a straight line between those two things?
Well, the line is extremely straight, because the industries themselves are promoting the skepticism that we've been talking about. That's where the argument comes from. It comes from industry, and it comes from think tanks on the right that are often supported by industry. That's where it filters into the political process in that way. The administration, this is why there's a Republican war on science, why it's political, because the Bush administration is a Republican administration, and it listens to industry, because industry is one of the Republican constituencies, and industry has its own spin on the science, and then the Bush administration reflects that spin.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Chris Mooney. He's a journalist who is particularly interested in the relation between science and politics, and he is Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine's magazine about science. He's also written for a number of other publications, American Prospect, Wired, Washington Post, Slate. His book, his first, is The Republican War on Science, and it's published by Basic Books and is out here fairly recently, come out over the last month or so, generate a lot of comment, and we have a couple of people here ready to go with questions. We want to call in. Questions are welcome from people listening. 333-9455, toll free, 800 1-800-222-9455. We have two callers here ready to go, both in Urbana, starting with line number one. Right here. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. This is really a very important subject, and I think your book's really important.
Thank you.
In a way that what I've always sort of noticed about this, as I go back to James Watt when in the Republican administration of, you know, Reagan's administration in the 80s, I saw an interview with him, and he was talking about, you know, he was the Department of the Interior, head of the Department of Interior, and he was talking about how, well, we don't have to worry about all this stuff because the end time, you know, Christ is coming. No, he didn't literally say Christ, but, you know, the end time, the eschatological nonsense of Christianity. And I think there's really a religious core to a lot of their thinking, in that they're sort of like, well, you know, God created the universe and everything is like his will and all this stuff. And I think there's a corporate bent. I think that's sort of the sort of a political disguise they use. But underneath it is sort of this whole religious, you know, end of time thing. And that's not really acknowledged. I mean, people sort of like kind of wink and say, yeah, Bush is kind of, you know, he's real religious. Jesus is his favorite philosopher and all that stuff. But a lot of that's tied into that sort of, you know, Book of Revelation deal. And but they don't overtly say it, but it's underneath all of their thinking. And I'm wondering if you've thought of that part in your book, or if you mentioned that in your book.
I don't. It's a great question. I don't, in the book, specifically bring up sort of whether anti-environmentalism on the right springs from this Christian conservative view that the world is ending anyway, so that we don't necessarily have to worry about the environment. You know, I mean, that's out there, and some people have been singling it out, and I haven't delved into it that far. The war on science that I talk about has a clear Christian conservative component, but it is, in my view, centrally because Christian conservatives want to attack evolution, want to attack embryonic stem cell research, want to attack safe sex education.
Can I just mention one other thing? I was sort of think of science as like a, you know, it's an event that's a human event. We, you know, created this process to look at things. And I was noticing that the Koreans had developed, you know, stem cell cloning or clone embryos for stem cells. And everybody in this country is kind of like, you know, what are we going to do about that? But do you think that science could literally, like the path of least resistance, like electricity, shift to whichever countries or societies are willing to just go wherever they, you know, science takes them, and just leave us behind more or less if we're stuck in this, let's say, political theological combination that basically says we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that because moral reasons or whatever? Do you think that the shift could move to like the Asia, not just economically but scientifically, because of if you know they're just more willing to do this stuff than we are? Do you think that might be possible?
Yeah, sure. There's no law that says that the United States will always lead the world in science, and we have.
We have, I think, because we were really open for a long time. But I think, you know, because we allowed all, you know, the persecution of the Jewish scientists, they all came here, and like our Germans, you know, versus the Russians-Germans thing. But I'm wondering about that. I thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Sure. Something to be concerned about.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi.
You're talking about a lot of things important to me, but I two comments I'd like to emphasize. It seems to me that the right emphasizes a misunderstanding of the word theory, as in big T theory, versus I never hear anybody talking about a hypothesis. People talk about, for instance, the theory of evolution as though it's a hypothesis, which it means I've got an idea, let's check it out. A big T theory, as I understand it, is something that we pretty much understand. And we're working on some of the little details, but it's pretty much everything keeps fitting into the big T theory. If we don't understand evolution, how are we going to deal with pests that are evolving as our climate changes? And that leads me to also say, even using the word climate change, global warming, and I think that they also are exploiting that term, because it's more complex than global warming. It's global climate change. As an example, the melting of the polar ice caps is contributing to, and there's evidence, there were models for it, now there's evidence that it's happening, a change in the way that the Gulf Stream flows up the North American coast and over to warm England and parts of Northern Europe. And if that engine of, that brings warmth up into that part of the world changes because of the change in the salinity and in the ocean up there, and because of the change in if cold water is sinking because the cold water is not cold enough, you're going to have a major problem in Northern Europe, and it might be a cold problem instead of a warm problem. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. First of all, it's true that part of the war on science is really just spin and misusing words and terms and so forth. It's true that climate change is a very accurate term. We should use that term. I mean, global warming, of course, also does describe a lot of what we're talking about as well. And of course, in the evolutionary, the misuse of language is part of, and partial of the attack on science. So evolution is derided as just a theory, when in fact, of course, a theory is pretty much the pinnacle in science, because a theory is an explanation that's been well-tested and unifies a broad range of observations. But the anti-evolutionists have done a very good job in denigrating evolution as just a theory.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We will continue here. And the next caller is in Champaign, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I'm not a scientist, but I'm really intrigued by your discussion. One thing that I'm really concerned about is that I don't quite understand in historical terms and in social terms how it is that the American people do not seem to understand the extent to which this particular administration, more than, let's say, the Reagan administration, is not simply bending science towards its own ends, but is of a kind of different from other administrations in terms of it's not just its treatment of science, but across the board. And what I ascribe it to in part is a kind of anti-professionalism. In other words, the reduction of scientific decisions, but also decisions with regard to other branches of the government and policy to business interests or other extreme, let's say, ideological interests related to the Republican Party in particular. And so I'm just wondering, there is, you know, when one thinks about with regard to science itself, even on the one hand, while this administration is extremely unique, there's also an historical aspect to this, which is when one thinks about the rise of HMOs and so on, which involve medical decisions being reduced to what being made by ultimately by business people, people who are administrators and who don't know really about the science, the medicine, unlike the doctors, that there was already to some extent this climate that had been created over time. And of course, the climate in part is related to the this broadly anti-intellectual movement that I think you're probably talking about in your book in the Republican Party, especially the religious right, starting with the moral majority and so on. So I'm just wondering, you know, how it is that we educate the populace to the obvious fact that this administration is in some ways off the deep end in a variety of ways. You know, how is it that we in particular reach the media? Because the media, as Paul Krugman says, they'll say, well, if someone said that, you know, the sun doesn't come up every morning, the moon does, or Venus or something, that someone would say, well, someone says you know, the moon instead comes up, you know, but others disagree. And they simply sort of reduce it to sort of relativize arguments to the point where if you're talking about intelligent design, even in the New York Times, they're treating intelligent design almost as a kind of major theory. They had large articles on this recently, and I was baffled that even anyone, especially the New York Times, would bother granting a platform to what is not even a theory. I'm just interested in what your view is on this in broader terms.
Well, there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. First of all, I wrote a book called The Republican War on Science because that was about as much as I could bite off and chew for one book. And I agree with you that the war on science is part of a war on expertise and a war on professionalism. Mm-hmm. The media has actually understood this story, I think, in the sense that they are now realizing that there's a narrative about cronyism in the Bush administration.
Right.
And they're realizing that people not competent to do their jobs are being put in positions of authority, whether it is in constitutional law or emergency management.
Right.
Or, of course, science is an area where there's a lot of expertise and professionalism, too. And so what I'm talking about can be subsumed under this broader heading of war on competence, war on expertise. But, you know, science is one of the key areas where people who know a lot of stuff about specific topics are being disregarded.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are about at a midpoint here. We have another caller I get right to in just a moment, but I want to take the time to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Chris Mooney. He's a journalist. One of his big interests is this intersection of science and politics. He's Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine, has written for a number of other publications, including The American Prospect and Wired and The Washington Post and Slate. His book is The Republican War on Science. It's published by Basic Books and has been out now for, I guess, about a month or so. And you can find it out in the bookstore if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome here, too. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Next up is someone calling here from Champaign County. Line 1. Hello.
Hi. On the general issues, I'm reminded of Susskind's interaction with somebody at the White House about we make the facts, you know, we don't need to be reality-based or something. There's some arrogance there that kind of undermines any kind of idea of Christian humility, for one. But I'd like to get to some of the specifics, and there's so many of them that maybe you need to catalog them first, the specifics of whistleblowers being attacked and suppressed, et cetera, et cetera. There's a Supreme Court case that's in the criminal field, but the implications about whistleblowers and what they will be allowed to do, how much free speech inside of a government institution there is quite chilling. There's a website, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, peer.org, that has a lot of resources on these kind of challenges. There was a very poorly reported on whistleblower bill that was promoted in the Congress, where maybe a remedy could be pushed through, but not with the current breakdown or constituencies being represented. So I'd really like to hear you go through at least some of these anecdotal cases of, and to point out how that's the piece that represents the whole. And I guess I'll hang up and listen since you're getting a lot of calls. So thank
you. All right. Thank you.
Sure. Well, one of the reasons that the various scandals in terms of the misuse of science in the Bush administration have emerged is because there have been courageous scientists and government agencies who have been willing to blow the whistle and say that something really wrong is going on here now and I have to make it more widely known. That's where a lot of the outrages and stories originally come from, and there have been whistleblowers in such a wide variety of areas now, and there's legislation to protect them better, specifically scientific whistleblowers, because of these scandals, but of course it's Democrat legislation, it's seen as partisan, so the Republicans don't want to do it. So the most recent, most high-profile whistleblower was Susan Wood, who left the FDA over the continual politicking over whether to approve Plan B emergency contraception, the morning after pill. And actually, I'm appearing on several panels with her in the near future. So she's been a great, courageous whistleblower who said that the science is being misused and or ignored by the FDA because the science clearly shows this drug is safe and effective. Before that, there was Rick Piltz, who was a whistleblower from the Climate Change Science Program and who went public and actually got lots of attention with allegations that scientific reports were actually being edited by the White House in a way that basically words like may and maybe and other things that heighten the sense of uncertainty were being put into the descriptions of the science. So that's another whistleblower. But there really are these kinds of stories at just most federal agencies that you can think of.
All right. Has there been some, maybe you have touched on this a little bit, but I'm interested in maybe another example or two. We talked about one thing that you have said the administration does, and that in order to muddy the science is to play up the fact that there on some particular questions there may not be 100% agreement among scientists. But you also charge that the administration has actually promulgated, put out there, tried to put out there information that is demonstrably untrue. It has promoted some particular kind of bit information that is just simply wrong, is simply false.
Right.
Can you give an example or two?
Sure. Well, the president stood before the nation and claimed that there would be more than 60 embryonic stem cell lines available for research under his policy on August 9, 2001. Well, guess what? That was completely false. There are not more than 60 lines. There are 22, and scientists will tell you that only a fraction of those are scientifically useful or interesting. And if the president had vetted his information carefully, he should have known that the more than 60 number was wrong, because, of course, scientists immediately complained, we don't know about any 60 SEMSA lines, and the claim turns out to have been based upon a very elementary scientific confusion. So that's just factual misinformation.
Well, but is that a case of a willfully stating something that was wrong, or just sloppy research on somebody's part so that they said something that was wrong, but they didn't do it knowingly?
Well, how do we know exactly what happened there? It's not there's no way to answer that question. We don't know if someone was willfully lying or if someone just didn't bother to vet the scientific information carefully. We do know this. It's the president making a major policy address on the first issue that he really had to make a decision on, and his address was going to be watched by millions of people. And yet there was no attempt to actually check the information. I find that hard to believe. If there was really, then that's just a cavalier disregard for science. And, you know, the president maybe didn't have a scientific advisory apparatus set up at the time, but that's inexcusable too. And of course, so the president should not make that kind of elementary error. The president has scientists across the country who would be happy to advise him. And if he isn't setting up a process like that, that's inexcusable. Furthermore, the president did not then apologize when it was pointed out that he had made an error, and there's still been no apology. And in fact, the misinformation was central to the policy, and the policy has not been changed despite the fact that the misinformation has been exposed. So it's not particularly forgivable. Hmm.
The White House, and I believe that this is true, although it took a long time to appoint someone, there is someone who is designated to be the official advisor on science to the White House?
Yes. This person was not officially in place at the time that Bush made that decision. And as I report in my book, there was actually a holdover from the Clinton administration, a science advisor who was still in the White House, but who was not consulted.
We have a number of other callers. In fact, the lines are full, so we will continue to talk with people listening. And go next to an Urbana caller, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. It's kind of interesting to listen to this discussion. I wanted to make a couple of comments. One is that that person that called earlier about decrying the question of intelligent design, I just don't agree, and I'm not a religious person at all. I really enjoy the questioning and testing of hypotheses and all that, but I think this is a really good example of how the scientific community really mishandles questions, and that's one of my key points, is that it's a question, it's not a theory, or rather, a lot of people answer the question by saying that this is proof of a deity, etc. But why the scientific community succumbs to that, I don't understand. They should just keep it a question. Can our physical laws account for our reality without some sort of intelligent design? And I think that's a valid question. And their inability to deal with that, I think, really is really their own fault. You might want to comment on that or not, but I've got other things I wanted to bring up.
And we have a lot of other callers, too. But I'm interested in actually, yes, hearing what Chris Mooney might want to say to that.
I'm not sure why the scientific community is unable to deal with it. It's not a scientific question, and all the scientific community is saying is that it's not a scientific question.
Well, that is not all the scientific community is saying. They jump over the question consistently and go to the religious response or solution to the question. They hardly ever hit the question itself.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, because, for example, well, I'll just briefly say this. When they talk about evolution, I think there isn't one scientist out there who's going to tell you that evolution answers the question how life itself is created. And there just isn't, and yet that's key in part of this whole question. But anyway, let me ask you this other
thing. So what? You're not making a point.
Well, perhaps you don't see it.
No, there isn't a point here. So what's the next question?
The one thing you're not talking about, which is very key to this whole thing, I think, is the way science is being handled in the courts, and particularly in the civil courts, and that I haven't heard anybody mention how, except in one instance in one article, how the Supreme Court has set it up so that judges can increasingly screen who's a reliable expert witness and who isn't, and yet these judges haven't the faintest idea of what hypothesis testing is all about and the significance of error rates, et cetera, et cetera. I'll let you comment on that.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I like the second point much better. I didn't understand the first. It's true. It's called the Daubert decision. The Supreme Court has empowered judges in trial courts to decide who's an expert and who isn't. And this has unfortunately, perhaps predictably, led to a scenario in which specifically industry, which has a lot of money in lawsuits, and often tort lawsuits, they go out of their way to attack and try to discredit various people who have, you know, very good expertise, but you can file a Daubert motion and try to exclude somebody's testimony. And this is, of course, led to a lot of abuses and politicization of science in the courtroom.
We have several callers. We have about 15 minutes in this hour of Focus. Again, our guest is Chris Mooney. His book is The Republican War on Science. He's a journalist, and he writes for Seed Magazine. He's the Washington correspondent. And questions welcome. We'll get in as many people as we can. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And the next caller in line is in Urbana, and it's line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Okay. Well, just some observations. I've been involved in science, well, since grade school, basically. And an observation I've made is that it's quite common for scientists to take data, which appear to be facts, observations from their research, string a bunch of data together, observations, and then make conclusions and then state the conclusions as being fact when you can't really do that in many cases. I mean, scientists all the time look at the same data and draw different conclusions and then try to pass the conclusions off as being fact. Drug companies do this at different times, and food researchers, somebody makes an observation and then somebody else takes it and starts promoting it as fact when it's just someone's interpretation of data. I work among scientists now, and they're all the time disagreeing and finding that something they were promoting as fact at one point, they later discover it's wrong. I think some people in the country, in an effort to, well, whatever their effort is, sometimes just to promote their own point, use the data as they see fit, promote just for self-promotion or promote their idea. If a scientist, an archaeologist, or anyone has 20 or 30 years wrapped up in their research, they want the conclusion of the data they've collected to support what they've been trying to prove for the last 20 or 30 years. So they often kind of bend the data, or sometimes not intentionally, unconsciously, just to try to prove their point, to support, to make all the effort they've been doing worthwhile.
These are good points. Thank goodness, but you've also described the solution, which is, of course, that other scientists disagree and other scientists catch this and check it, and it's hopefully out of this cumulative process of a lot of scientists disagreeing and having different interpretations of data, that we reach some sort of reliable interpretation of data, hopefully.
Ever since when evolution was first presented to me in junior high and high school in the text, they said, somebody found a fossil here, somebody found another fossil there, So that shows that this type of animal evolved from that type of animal. And from the very beginning, I thought, well, how can you make that jumping conclusion? And even to this point with evolution, the data, you know, clearly shows that, you know, things evolve within species. You know, fruit flies evolve, other creatures. We have evidence of that, but we don't have proof or fact that one type of creature evolved into another. That
oh, is that where this is going? Oh, well, so you misled me. Oh,
no,
so now this is an attack on evolution.
Well,
oh, good God.
It's not an attack on evolution. It's an
yes,
attack
it
on use of...
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I mean, come on, man.
Okay, I mean, I understand that you interpret facts the way you want to prove your points.
No, me and in this case, the entire scientific community, anyone who knows anything in evolutionary biology knows there's an overwhelming body of evidence that supports the theory of evolution.
Why do scientists have such a difficult time presenting that? I watched documentaries on Discovery Channel.
There's massive amounts of evidence supporting evolution. And that's
evolution, yes, but evolution from one species to another. That
yes, of course, yes.
Why is it so?
why do we have such a overlap in genomes with chimpanzees? You know, and why, in fact, does the more the DNA overlap that there is, correlate directly with how closely related one is?
Does that prove that one evolved from another or that they evolved from the same source?
It's part of the huge body of evidence that collectively makes that a very strong conclusion.
It makes it a very strong conclusion, but doesn't make it fact.
Well, it's the best thing we have.
Yeah, exactly. Want? It is the best thing we have, but it doesn't prove it. Could you prove it in court?
Yes,
from that
you prove it in court.
I hope you both won't mind if I jump in, because I don't think the purpose of the program, as we started out, was to debate evolution particularly. And we could go on for a long time, but we don't have the time to do that. We have some other callers, though, and with the indulgence of both the guest and the caller, I'm going to go on. And we do only have about 5 or 7 minutes in any case. Let's go to Farina, Illinois, for the next call. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Interesting topic. I've just been thinking about this recently. The Republicans and the Bush administration should be ashamed of themselves for subverting basic shared wisdom on a number of things. And let me just say a couple of things. The thing about the hydrogen economy that Bush proposes, they must have gone to great lengths to figure out the worst way to go about it, to build nuclear power plants to crack petroleum for hydrogen. And then the other thing about going to Mars, what about funding other basic space research, going to the moon first, building up? They're talking about pulling out of the ISS, the space station, and letting Hubble crash the ground, but no, they want to go to Mars first. This undermines another point that the defunding of basic research is another one, and turning the research over to corporations on all levels, the patenting of life, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what is youth coming up is going to question just basic precepts because they can't trust what the government says. When they know that they're lying about a war and people dying, how can they trust anything that comes down, including aspects of science? And that's my rant for this morning.
Okay. Well, Chris, do you want to respond to
some
of what the caller said?
Yeah, well, it's true. We do have good reasons to doubt the credibility of the government, and I generally don't think that we can trust the government, this government, when it comes to claims about science in controversial areas. And I think that that's a really sad state of affairs, but they have repeatedly shown themselves to be untrustworthy, and that is the only conclusion that we can reach based upon past behavior. Some of the other things that are brought up, the trip to Mars, funding of science, and so forth, these are matters that are called policy for science. So in other words, what kind of funding will you give to different kinds of research endeavors? And these are things that I think that politicians do have to make judgments about, and that those are legitimate judgments because we do put politicians into power to decide what to do with our money. It's different than science for policy, which is, of course, what kind of scientific information will lead to decision-making in a wide variety of areas. And I'm centrally focusing on science for policy because I think there's a lot of attacks on the science in order to keep it from influencing certain policy decisions that have nothing to do with what science can be funded, but rather to do with what action are we going to take to protect public health and the environment.
Let's go to another caller. This is Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Well, maybe this is a question that we can kind of come towards the end on. How is this any different than what Galileo faced hundreds of years ago? One group says that science is, this is where it's going to stop, and this is what it's all about. And another group says, no, I have evidence that says otherwise.
Well, Galileo was attacked by the church.
Yeah, because they said the Earth was in the center of the universe. Now we've proven otherwise. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things still today that we don't know, and the government seems to want to say, no, this is where we're going to stop thinking about. This has been something that's been going on forever and ever and ever.
Well, there's certainly always been some tension between science and between other forms of authority. I grant you that. We have a current crisis over the Bush administration misusing science, which is unprecedented in recent American political history, and past, I don't know if this is the implication, but past crises over science and authority not liking what science is finding, or people in power not liking what science is finding, those problems do not in any way negate the severity of the problem that we currently face.
Oh, I agree with you 100%, sir. I was just pointing out that it seems like we are always on this treadmill that never quits.
Well, that's there's an inherent tension here.
Thank you.
But that gets back to, and forgive me for maybe going back over ground we've been over, but I guess that gets back to the question, given the fact that there are different ways to fund science, and there are a lot of different people doing science, and it's not something that government is in a position to control, at least not completely. Is it the case, do you think, that government is actually preventing science from being done?
I don't see a lot of evidence for that. I mean, there are some allegations that are in that direction, but generally, I think that the issue is not, suppression of actual research being done.
Then going back to the central argument of the book and even the very title of the book, then is really the issue here not as much of the impact on science itself, whether science is being done, but it more has to do with public perception of science, the state of scientific knowledge,
attack is on the conclusions of science, not the fact that research is being done, but that's still an attack on science.
Uh-huh. And though that does. Where though, I guess I'm coming back to the question of what's the problem? I mean, what's the real, why is that a problem? Why is that something to be concerned about?
Well, you don't think misinformation is a problem? You don't, I mean, the problem is that we are being misinformed by our leaders.
I guess that would only be a problem if there were no contrary voices saying, like yours, or other people in the media looking at what the leaders say and then saying, okay, this is what the president says, but this is in fact the fact. And this may indeed go to the issue of how science is reported. And if the media is not doing that, then we definitely have a problem. I guess that's...
No, I mean, it's wrong for the president to mislead us even if nobody catches it. You know, it's not just that as long as someone's keeping him in check, you know, it's fine. No, it's not fine. It's not fine for the president to mislead us or for our political leaders. It's not fine for Senator Inhofe to stand up and suggest that global warming is a hoax. It's not fine. It's misinformation. And these people, we put them in power, we place our trust in them. Mm-hmm. And they have no business lying to us, misleading us, distorting information. Just inappropriate, wrong, and they should be voted out if they do that.
Let's see if we can get at least one more caller. Ann Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I don't know if you have time, but I was wanting to know if you could elaborate a little bit more on the politics of the space program. It does seem there's a lot of politics to send people back to the moon or Mars, and presumably that would be at the expense of other projects, newer ideas, you know, that might enhance a scientist's understanding of the universe. I wanted to know if you discussed that in your book at all.
I don't discuss it in the book because this is, in the end, a policy disagreement. There's a legitimate policy disagreement about how to spend money doing what. And I think politicians are entitled to make such judgments about whether we want to divert the money to a moon-Mars trip or whether we want to spend the money on more basic kinds of research. And I know scientists are largely in the second camp. But I do also think that you can make decisions about what to do with money that aren't necessarily strictly based on what scientists want. That's fine. What you cannot do is mislead people, mislead the public about science. distort science, and that is really where I'm coming down.
I acknowledge your point about it, whether somebody calls the president out or not. If the president, for example, we're just talking about the president, if the president is misleading the people, that's wrong. Let me just stay for a second with science reporting, and I wonder what overall how you think that and media, and obviously we're talking about a lot of people, a lot of reporters, a lot of media outlets. Generally speaking, though, what do you say about the quality of science reporting?
Well, I think science writers themselves are great, generally. The problem is when people who are not science writers are called upon to write about these topics, because the topics become politically fraught, and then topics get kicked over to political reporters or, you know, talk shows, et cetera. And then, actually, is when the press does not always do as good a job of reflecting what's known in science, which is something that science writers who deal with this every day, they understand the technical details and they convey those. Political writers are looking for controversy and often don't give a very good background on the science and are sometimes inclined to create false controversy.
Well, there we're going to have to stop because we have used the time. The book that we have been talking about is The Republican War on Science. It's published by Basic Books and is just out by our guest Chris Mooney. He's Washington correspondent for Seed magazine. He's also written for American Prospect, Wired, Washington Post, Slate, other publications. And Mr. Mooney, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for this show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The support for the broadcast today also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Coming up in the next hour, I think we'll take up some of the questions here that have come up, in a sense, just in the last little bit of this program. We'll be talking about space and the exploration of space, and our guest will be Harrison Schmitt, one of only 12 human beings ever to have stood on the surface of the moon. More on that in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for an update on the news and the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandEnergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. Soybean